Hello, everyone. Welcome to the first of the lectures being given by the Slade Professor of Fine Art for 2021. These lectures are an important tradition at the University of Oxford. John Ruskin began this tradition by presenting a series of public lectures on art in 1870, after being appointed as the initial Slade Professor of Fine Art. Every year, a distinguished scholar is asked to follow in his footsteps. My name is Geoffrey Batchen, and I am Professor of the History of Art at the University of Oxford. It is my great pleasure to introduce this year's Slade Professor, Dr. Geraldine D. Dodds. Jerry Dodds is Harlequin Adair Damon Professor, Faculty of Art History at Sarah Lawrence College in the United States. Professor Dodds' scholarly work has centered on medieval Iberian art and architecture, and especially on issues of transculturation and identity formation. Among her publications are Arts of Intimacy, Christians, Jews, and Muslims in the Making of Castilian Culture, a renowned co-authored textbook, another book titled Architecture and Ideology of Early Medieval Spain, and a third titled New York Masjid, the Mosques of New York City. In addition, in 1992, Jerry was editor of the catalogue Al-Andalus, the Arts of Islamic Spain, for the Metropolitan Museum of Art and the Alhambra, and served as curator of the exhibition of the same name. She was also co-editor and curatorial consultant for the Arts of Medieval Spain at the Metropolitan Museum, co-editor and consulting curator for Convivencia, the Arts of Jews, Christians, and Muslims in Medieval Iberia, and with Edward Sullivan, co-editor and curator for Crowning Glory, Images of the Virgin in the Arts of Portugal, the Newark Museum. Interestingly, she's also written and directed a number of films in conjunction with museum exhibitions, as well as for wider audiences. In 2018, in recognition of her exceptional contributions to the dissemination of knowledge of Spanish history and culture, Professor Dodds was the recipient of the Cross of the Order of Civil Merit from the government of Spain. We are honored that Professor Dodds has accepted our invitation to present this year's Slade lectures, and I now happily hand over the microphone to her.
Thank you so very much for those very generous words. It's an enormous pleasure and honor to speak to you today as Slade lecturer. Before beginning, I wish to extend my deepest gratitude to all of those who have worked under these very unprecedented constraints to allow me to deliver these lectures. In particular, Neil Mendoza, Provost of Oriel College, and the Committee for Slade Lectures, Holly Knights and Liz Green of the Torch Team, who literally made this possible, and most especially, I wish to thank Gervaise Rosser, Professor of Medieval Art in the Art History Department at Oxford, and Geoffrey Batchen, Professor of the History of Art and Head of Art History, for their practical and spiritual guidance in, as Professor Batchen would say, very unreal times. So the problem is, of course, maps like this, all maps like this, chromatically proposing a unity of identity aligned with religion, eclipsing political alliance, shrouding social complexity, fixing temporalities. These maps become an heuristic for visualizing medieval history retrospectively from the point of view of the moment of the erasure of the last kingdom ruled by Muslims on the Iberian Peninsula. The periods I wish to explore in these lectures begin at the fall of the Visigothic reign, also a time of discord and negotiation, and not always one of religious unity. And yet it's not until the advent of the polities ruled by Muslims on the peninsula that these chromatic demarcations begin to dominate graphically. With the Umayyad Emirate and then Caliphate, when disparate, often hostile principalities ruled by Christians are nevertheless united in one shade again, and continue in fictive unanimity as the great Umayyad state breaks down into multiple principalities, and a fragmented Christian north builds alliances across confessional boundaries, all of which is erased by the privileging of the religious binary the map projects. And this continues through the fall of the Kingdom of Granada and its demise in 1492 with the rise, of the Kingdom of Spain, when Isabel of Castile married Ferdinand of Aragon, although the prenup indicated that a dynastic union would be of two separate states. The Christians were still not unified. Now, I need to say that these particular maps were made for a book that wished to tell a far more complex story, but that was so much the way in which we visualize things, that this message went so unquestioned by the author 30 years ago, who was, of course, me. The desire to construct a clear history regarding a medieval demographic that does not exist today means that we tend to project the issues that seem most extraordinary to us onto the past. And what's most extraordinary to us, whether we view this as an interesting or benevolent thing, or whether we view it as threatening, what's most extraordinary to us is to imagine a Western European place shared by Muslims and Christians under conditions of Muslim hegemony. Walter Mignolo reminded us of the ways in which reconceiving borders can recenter our epistemological and hermeneutic habits. So perhaps one way to begin is to embrace the chaos of places without the clear borders of religions. And that's something, by the way, that Rose Walker approached rather courageously in her recent survey. Of course, these principalities themselves, both those ruled by Muslims and Christians, also wish to assert that their identities were defined by religions, because one of the few truths we can state as enduring throughout the periods we'll explore in these lectures is that an individual's religion was then a transcendent factor of social and political identity. But however sincerely felt, uniquely sectarian categories of identity are enormously inadequate to the study of medieval Iberia. Muslims and Christians lived in societies that maintained legal, religious, and social stances of public hostility. But as Robert Burns has said, such public ritual expression consecrates societal hostility, but also frees participants from much of the burden of personal hostility. So Christians and Muslims joined, shared, worked together in economic, social, cultural, and intellectual spheres. This was not tolerance. That would not have been seen as a public virtue by either group. It was instead, in Burns's words, an effective ground for unremitting interaction. I wish to suggest in the next few weeks that one way we can mine that slippage, the way in which the discourse of a simple bipolar opposition between Muslims and Christians breaks down, is through a consultation of material culture that betrays its subconscious meanings, that holds its conscious assertions of separateness simultaneously with its ambivalent shared meanings. The approach involves mining both surface semantics asserted by works of art and also the web of deeper meanings engendered by social, political, and economic forces. It's not so much about actual alterity as it is about the perception and instrumentalization of alterity within cultural expression. I'd like to begin here in the last years of the Great Umayyad Caliphate, which we're going to talk about next week, not in its capital, but in Toledo, the former metropolis founded on the site of the capital of the former Visigothic monarchy it had replaced. We can descend one of Toledo's vertiginous hills to the Mosque of Ibn al-Hadidi, named for its patron, also known as the Mosque of Bab al-Mardum, after the gate of the city near which it was built. It was constructed in an elite sector of the city, not far from the Dualnunig Palace in 999, where it was a pious foundation, meant to serve as a neighborhood mosque for daily prayer, and also perhaps as a site for learned pursuit of the elites who were its patrons. Its nine-bay plan makes it like a little miniature hypostyle mosque, 8 meters square, open on two sides with a closed Qibla wall. The Qibla wall is, of course, the wall facing Mecca to the southeast. However, the interior opens up to a tiered set of nine ribbed domes. These Christian Evert saw as a miniature vertical version of a maksura, a space set aside near the mihrab for the prayer of elites of the great mosque of Cordoba. There's the Cordoba Mixora. Now, such private foundations of nine bay mosques are found throughout the lands of Islam, in North Africa or Central Asia, but though they share some plan types, they are wildly divergent in elevation, echoing not each other, but the moksuras of more august foundations in their own regions. In this way, these little mosques visually knit together devotional spaces that are not bound by a central religious hierarchy. From Susanna Calvo Capilla, we learned that this mosque's founder, Ahmad ibn al-Hadidi al-Tulaituli, the Tulidan, was likely instrumental in these references to the Great Mosque of Cordoba. Ibn al-Khatib tells us that he was a cultured and erudite faqih who was honored to be among those present in Cordoba in 976 for the acclamation ceremony of the Umayyad Caliph Hisham. And so he saw himself the opulent additions that Hisham's father, Al-Hakam II, had made there. Reflections of Cordoba can also be seen in the little mosque's polylobed arches, interlacing arches, and red and white voussoirs, all constructed in the little mosque in local Toledan brick tradition. We cannot trace how his architect, Musa ibn Ali, learned to reference them, or, as is likely, if explicit references to Cordoba existed in other foundations of Taifa Toledo as well. I'm sorry, not Taifa Toledo, Umayyad Toledo as well. But the elaborate way in which Cordoba is referenced here must be seen in part as echoing the career and prominence of its founder. And it subsequently became a model for Taifa Toledo, for the oratory in the later Nundid Palace nearby, as Calvo has shown, and also it spawned a tiny copy of the little mosque of Las Tornerias built in the market near the Taifa rule, during the Taifa rule of Al-Mahmun or of his grandson Yahya. And yet the mosque of Ibn al-Hadidi would become something else altogether under Castilian rule, 186 years after its original construction. Around 1185, an enormous apse and transept were grafted onto the eastern side of the fragile Nine Bay Pavilion, subsuming it without entirely erasing it, incorporating the mosque building into the Church of the Holy Cross, Santa Cruz. The transept is only faintly expressed on the exterior, emphasizing the fissure between the two buildings. The effect today is of a voluminous apse poised an incident before it consumes the mosque, which becomes a kind of spoil of war in a neat bipolar image, entirely in keeping with its new 12th century patrons, the Knights of the Hospital of St. John. They were in military order, born in the Holy Land, but now in Iberia to aid both in military confrontation with Muslims and in transforming the troubled alliances of Iberian kings, in this case, Alfonso VIII of Castile, into the more regimented confessional opposition of crusade. It's a compact, uncomplicated image of Christian victory over a reductive Islam. The destruction of the Qibla wall, the creation of a divergent and axialized orientation, constituted a stage set for the emergence of new social and political powers within the economy of conquest. But as those new actors emerged, the very act of conversion fragmented and complicated the discourse that strove towards a morality constructed around two simple, unequivocal poles. We might best step back for a moment to the changes of the previous two centuries in Toledo. Less than a decade after the construction of the little mosque, the Umayyad Caliphate fell, and its lands fragmented into a number of small Taifa kingdoms, of which Toledo was one. These were heirs to the rich culture of the Umayyads, but not to their military capacity, creating more interdependent alliances with the kingdoms ruled by Christians. Political relationships rarely polarized uniquely on the basis of religion, for the Taifa struggled with one another, as did the sometimes fratricidal kingdoms of León, Castile, Galicia, and Aragon in the north, and anyone might as easily take a Christian king for an ally as a Muslim ruler. And as the northern kingdom strengthened over time, they did not at first seek to occupy or Christianize Taifa lands, but instead extorted colossal tribute, parayas, and military duties from the often fragile kingdoms. The fall of the city of Toledo from Muslim to Christian hands occurred in 1095, a century before the foundation of Santa Cruz. The Taifa state of Toledo had already been in the Castilians' clients for some time, and Alfonso VI of León and Castile shuffled its ineffectual ruler, Al-Qadir, off to a sinecure in Valencia. The administration of the city of Toledo had been in tatters, and Ibn Bassam tells us that the very scion of the Banu'i Hadidi, a minister and the grandson of the founder of the mosque, was assassinated in the street, an act believed by some to have been decisive in the capitulation of the city, already shrouded in paranoia and uncertainty to its Castilian overlord. After a protracted siege, Rodrigo Jimenez de Rada accounts, Alfonso VI took Toledo, holding court in the palace of his former client, Al-Mahmun, possessing its gardens, its reception rooms, its diminutive Palatine mosque. And a year later, Alfonso also appropriated Toledo's primary congregational mosque, converting it into a cathedral in alliance with his new Cluniac Archbishop, Bernard of Sedirac. About this building, we know from investigations only that it is reconstructed as a hypostyle mosque of 11 aisles, something like 39 by 61 meters, and might have possessed some forms recalling the Great Mosque of Cordoba, though I show you other vestiges of Islamic Toledo so as not to push the point. Because the point is to imagine the material presence of a mosque converted to a cathedral. Imagine worshiping in its hypostyle hall, wrenched now towards the east with a growing line of chapels carved from its Qibla wall. Its new altars, as Tom Nixon has shown, were endowed with relics by the Pope and Alfonso himself. And Tom is surely correct to suppose that parts were soon painted. The mosque turned cathedral was a powerful stage set for the performance of military and ecclesiastical victory, an experiential spoil of war. But it was also a manifestation of deep devotion, intensified in the face of another. There's little as moving in this regard as the memory of James of Aragon, who just after the submission of Murcia in the 13th century, recalled in his Book of Deeds, erecting an altar to the Virgin in the principal mosque. Embracing the altar, the formidable conqueror wrote, "We wept so strongly and so heartily that for the time it takes to go a mile, we could not stop crying nor leave the altar." Perhaps for this very reason, the body of the mosque, thus repurposed, also became powerfully polysemous. Its forest of columns would become the principal site of worship for Toledo's Christian community for over 130 years. Prominent families buried their dead in its san, in its courtyard. The altars that masked its Qibla now housed relics that were indexical to holy bodies, fervently revered material sites of intersection with the divine. The mosque's conversion to cathedral served to bring Toledan Christians into intimate and proprietary contact with its own language of expression, the visual environment for a phenomenological transformation of community experience that flowed above and around the simple imposition of a narrative of Christian victory. With time, it would become increasingly difficult for religious alterity to be defined architecturally in Toledo, so that what had begun as a conversion had slipped into something like a translation or a détournement, appropriation and incorporation into a body of collective visual identity. Heather Ecker has shown the ways in which Alfonso's occupation of Toledo had been a testing ground for the formation of subsequent Castilian colonial policy. The city's neighborhood mosques were confiscated by treaty, dominated to the cathedral, and converted into parish churches around which new local colonial administration was organized. But the mosque of Ibn Hadidi was part of a domestic property, probably obtained in speculation or as a grant to a colonizer, and so it did not fall into episcopal hands. In the ensuing century, Toledo became once again a frontier with the advent of new North African dynasties, Almoravids, and subsequently the Almohads, who built a powerful empire in the Western Mediterranean by the middle of the 12th century. The idea of crusade, by then a consistent part of papal discourse, began to emerge as a strategic alternative for Christian Iberian monarchs, bringing a wider swath of personnel, fiduciary support, and a kind of high moral ground. Alfonso VI's grandson, Alfonso VII, would fight a crusade for the Almoravid port of Almeria, but he had nevertheless important Muslim vassals and allies, Saif al-Dawla of the Hudud dynasty, who also defended him against his Christian rivals, and Ibn Mardanish, called the Wolf King, who in Linehan's words fought with an absence of confessional conviction, at least the equal of that of the King of Leon. This alliance with Ibn Mardanish of Valencia and Murcia with Castile, light green on the map, and if you look at the map, you'll see why this is a bad map too, because Ibn Mardanish, who's light green, fought ardently against the Almohads, who are dark green, but that red line is there to remind you who the Christians are and who the Muslims are. It totally obscures the political situation. But I digress. Where was I? The alliance with Ibn Mardanish of Valencia and Murcia with Castile continued through the minority of Alfonso VIII, who secured his throne in Toledo by overcoming the supporters of his uncle, the very Ferdinand of whom Linehan spoke. And we very much lament Professor Linehan. One of the first to offer his fealty to the young Alfonso VIII was Ibn Mardanish himself, a ruler with his own anti-Almohad policy, who came to Toledo in 1167, personally renewing his vassalage with the little king. In return for his help in recuperating Alfonso's territories, a treaty would restrain the Aragonese from attacking Ibn Mardanish for 5 years, in return for a tribute of 40,000 morabetinos of gold. And we're going to get back to those morabetinos. But in 1172, Ibn Mardanish was killed, and the Almohad Caliph Abu Yusuf launched an expedition, appropriating his realm, an expansion that made a papacy ardent to expand the idea of crusade on the peninsula. Now, this map on the left from a wonderful new book about Alfonso VIII by Miguel Gomez, Kyle Lincoln, and Damian Smith is more like it. It's complicated, and I'm very sorry that I made such an awful scan of it, because it's really a useful map. In 1183, only 11 years after Ibn Mardanish's reception in Toledo, Juan Domingo Perez and his wife Juliana donated a little mosque on their property to the Knights of St. John of the hospital for a chapel dedicated to the Holy Cross. International military orders like the Hospitallers were essential to Alfonso VIII's crusading ambitions. He was glad of the manner in which they could garrison a castle against an Almohad foe that lingered very ominously to the south and east of Toledo. However, the international orders fit awkwardly into local ecclesiastical structures. An 1186 document that sets out the terms of the Hospitallers' right to make a church of this small mosque seethes with episcopal suspicion. It is clear, Barquero comments, that the king himself had to intervene to quiet the archbishop's opposition to the construction of even so small a church in Toledo by that order. Archbishop González Pérez finally allowed the celebration of Mass at Santa Cruz on condition that the Knights of St. John received no parishioners, nor tithes, nor first fruits, in addition to a multitude of other strict assurances of archiepiscopal authority. The order received the king's aid because it was serving both his spiritual and political program in this moment just after Alfonso's successful conquest of Cuenca, as his chancery began to fashion him as King of the Christians, allying him with Christianitatis, Christendom, not just the Christian cause, but a geographical place defined by Christianity, in opposition to Islam and making him parenthetically the peninsular defender of the faith. But unremarkably, there was trouble in paradise, as other Christian kings did not perform the requisite crusading image. Only the Spanish, Pope Celestine would lament in 1192, allied themselves with Saracens to war against other Christians. In 1195, addressing kings of Spain, the same pope threatened excommunication against monarchs like Alfonso XI of León, who would ally himself with the Almohads when convenient. Indeed, it's been suggested that the mosque of Ibn Hadidi fell into the hands of the Hospitallers in compensation for a hopeful series of military initiatives, and because their prior had intervened in a colloquium to broker a cessation of hostility between Alfonso and his uncle, Ferdinand II of León. Thus, the Hospitallers' compact monumental trophy of war was also an invitation to ignore the complexities and contradictions of that moment. Hostilities between military orders and cathedral chapters, and hostilities between Christian kings. Santa Cruz invites the viewer instead to repose in a simple bipolar opposition between Christianity and Islam writ large, with an eye to the future, to the New Jerusalem. This meaning resided not only in the building's obvious triumphalist gesture, its insistence that mosque and church belong to two different confessions. It is also present in the visible fissure between the mosque and church, which encoded a kind of temporal stratigraphy, revealing two distinct historical realities, before and after conquest. You might say that the renovated building chronicles this appropriation in the manner of a new memory eternally reenacted. If the op seems poised to devour the mosque, it repeatedly performs an ongoing military process in which the Knights of St. John were actively involved. Past and future are thus in dialogue. The physical rupture enacts a temporal one, as the ultimate eradication of Islam is materially, mythically predicted and celebrated. Now, I need, before going on to the rest of this, to thank a number of colleagues. If I haven't been able to be at Oxford, I've certainly had a wonderful intellectual community. In this case, Luli Feliciano, Abigail Balbale, and Umberto Bongianino for incredible discussions, a wonderful month-long virtual seminar, in fact, concerning the work that follows. Celestine III's bull of 1192 followed the capitulation of Jerusalem to Saladin in 1187. He, in fact, urged the kings of Spain to the kind of truce the Hospitallers mediated so that they might instead turn their hostilities to avenge the loss of Jerusalem. And I thank Miguel Gomez for help in this. Although there have been suggestions that the paintings of Santa Cruz responded to later crusading activities, we might instead think of drawing those same interpretations into this earlier time as part of the energetic days of the original rebuilding of the chapel in the late 1180s with Alfonso's aid. The years following the king's conquest of Cuenca, as he angled for the role of peninsular defender of the faith, buttressing his own peninsular power, as the Hospitallers scrambled to mediate those Iberian Christian alliances called for by successive popes, and before Alfonso's disastrous defeat at Alarcos. A formidable Christ Pantocrator against blue sky and a field of stars, attended by prophets and saints, and originally a tetramorph, is enormously imposing, even in its present abraded state, because of the outside scale of the apse with regard to the little then enclosed nine-bay nave. Its Latin inscriptions intensified this authority, especially the passage from Matthew 25, "Come, you blessed of my Father, possess you the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world." Miguel Gomez, who transcribed and studied these passages, argued convincingly that this is a triumphalist exhortation. The painting in all articulates the wider church's indisputable role as arbiter of the divine on earth, in a building where figural representation would have been unthinkable, very, 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 very few years before. Well, a century before, let's be honest. Two centuries before, sorry. The Christ in Majesty sacralizes the bellicose gesture of the chapel itself and the wars it memorializes in a building that would echo for centuries, a material embodiment of Jerusalem for future Spanish builders. It is also an embodiment of the ideas expressed in Celestine's 1192 bull, exhorting the Spanish kings to turn from each other to Jerusalem. How then, as we approach the task of practicing art history in medieval Iberia, do we reconcile these very triumphal, very international themes with the specific Spanish notion of reconquest? The term of reconquest suggests a continuous 7-century war of territorial recovery waged by Iberian Christians against Muslims in the name of confession. Let's try that again. A continuous 7-century war of territorial recovery waged by our Iberian Christians against Muslims in the name of confession. Depicted here in a remarkably obvious rainbow of territorial gain. This is the worst map that I'll show you. Far from being united in the cause of Christian context, these Spanish kings needed to be goaded. They needed actually to be threatened into unanimity by the papacy, by its legates, and by its military orders. There certainly existed in early medieval Iberia an intermittent teleological ardor to recuperate the lands and the ancient kingdom of the Visigoths. But the notion of a sustained program to restore the territorial domain of Christianity begins in earnest with the reformed papacy of the 11th and 12th centuries, which Demian Smith sees as gathering sporadic medieval Iberian ideas into a more formal concept, as the letters of popes to Iberian rulers become packed with terms like recuperare and restituire, offering a particularly Iberian extension of crusading ideology. You might say that reconquest was a rhetorical device developed to restrain Iberian kings from acting like Iberian kings. Santa Cruz was dragged into this corner of the discourse, not in the 12th century when it was built, but in the 19th century, in Reconquista's heyday, when Spanish identity became synonymic with triumphal Catholic confession. The Romantic period required for Santa Cruz more than a crusade. It required the recuperation of a lost kingdom. In his 1857 Historia de los Templos de España, Alfonso Becker recounts the legend behind one of Santa Cruz's name, Cristo de la Luz, Christ of the Light. King Alfonso the Sixth is imagined riding past the little mosque in his triumphal entry to Toledo, accompanied by the mythologized hero of the Reconquest, El Cid. This was impossible, of course, since the historical Rodrigo Díaz de Vivar, El Cid, was still in exile and not present at the taking of Toledo. He was, what's more, in the service of the Muslim ruler of Zaragoza, in whose behalf he waged war against the Christian counts of Barcelona and the King of Aragon. But in Becker's vision, the victorious entourage stops instead as the Cid's horse stops to kneel in front of the little mosque of Ibn al-Hadidi. The Cid investigates and finds hidden in a space beneath the mosque a crucifix, an image of the Virgin, and a Visigothic lamp that had miraculously remained illuminated for 300 years, awaiting the reconquest of the city by a Christian king. The addition of the Cid to the scene militarizes this image of Christian Toledo laying in wait for its reconquest, and it wraps it in a cloak of national unity, actually snatching the church of Santa Cruz from the grasp of the crusaders who fought for all Christendom, and then dedicating its capture instead to Spain, a Spain that would not even be thought of for another 3 centuries after the chapel was built. The idea of a lost, originary Visigothic church beneath the mosque which was given by subsequent scholars the dignity of a patron as grand as the Visigothic king Athanagild, clung to the site until the 1980s. This was still a very popular tourist narrative today, despite the archaeological record of the site, which makes it clear that there are no traces of the Visigothic church beneath it, no constructed stratigraphies at all between the mosque and the Roman road on top of which it was built, the archaeologist Ruiz Taboada has shown. This fictive history, Visigothic church followed by mosque, followed by once again victorious Christian chapel, creates a fairy tale ancestry for Santa Cruz and a kind of monumental genealogical diagram of Reconquista, an idea that did not die with the 19th century. Alejandro Garcia San Juan's recent biting critique of Reconquista's survival in contemporary discourse included this remark from former Spanish President José María Aznar, pictured here in a prophetic earlier article, dressed as El Cid. Aznar met a national fear of Islam after terrorist attacks in Madrid in 2004 with the same kind of 19th century pseudo-historical revisionism that we saw in Becker. His comment, "We are a nation made against Islam." But of course, these desperate narratives of conquest and erasure must eventually break down. Because even the triumphal incorporation of the little mosque into the chapel is accomplished through its integration, through multiple agents, into a wider artistic language that is local and transcultural, a now indigenous language of expression begun when Alfonso VI appropriated the Great Mosque of Toledo as the city's cathedral a century before. The dialogue with local builders resulted in a mantle of polylobed arches, an extension of the language in which the mosque is built. These ardent crusaders, even as they draw lines in the sand, have become part of, in David Raisman's words, a local living tradition of urban architecture. And then Santa Cruz's figural and epigraphic iconology of authority within is entirely inframed by sporadically legible Arabic calligraphy. Iconographically, Santa Cruz can be seen to be, and this is in Tom Nixon's words, authenticated by its exotic forms, the Arabic writing and high domes equating the building with the Holy Land. Such a meaning was explicit and not taken on passively, asserted Miguel Gomez, but as the expression of, quote, conscious conquerors. That said, this particular calligraphy is not generic. It is a fairly new and recognizable style that spells out al-yum, good fortune, and wal-iqbal, and prosperity, occasionally incorrectly suggesting that it was transcribed by the painter from a copy book, perhaps without understanding. The message is commonly paired on widely disseminated luxury objects. The combination repeatedly appears on stamped ceramics, on an ivory inlaid flute, for instance. The use of Arabic in the Chapel of Santa Cruz has thus often been considered in terms of confessional demographics through the much contested term convivencia. And by now you will have seen, as we make another detour, that what is most conflictive in the history of art is actually our agonistic historiographical tradition, at the center of which is this apparently harmless term. In Spanish, convivencia means the fact of living together without placing a value judgment on the quality of the cohabitation. It appeared in the work of the distinguished philologist Ramon Menéndez Pidal, but entered enduring critical discourse when his student, Américo Castro, used it to develop the impact of the lived experience of what he termed three castes, Christians, Muslims, and Jews, whose interaction proved productive and stimulating in framing Spanish identity through times of both peace and conflict. Convivencia did not signify for him tolerance or harmony. Indeed, he saw each caste as forced to live with the other two at the same time it passionately desired their extermination. And this revealed the term's most persistent problem, the assumption of uniquely sectarian identities, as if Toledo's Franks and Castilians and Mozarabs, as Christians, were united in cultural, social, and political identity. An idealized version of convivencia served in the past to mystify interactions between religious groups while simultaneously fetishizing their differences. Though now superseded, our present inability to let go has more recently been focused on rehearsing Castro's dispute with Claudio Sanchez Albornoz, or on quite learned analyses of the term, which I take to be a kind of scholarly methadone. Even as we abandon convivencia, we're kept, laments Lucy Pick, in the Spain is different school of historiography, as if these conditions existed in no other place. Popular notions of convivencia are perceived today as an answer to the right-wing embrace of a Reconquista, or to Samuel Huntington's reductive clash of civilizations. Convivencia as the collective projection of a 21st century ideal of tolerance that the 21st century cannot itself achieve. The city of Toledo is still enmeshed in its well-known tourist campaign, Ciudad de las Tres Culturas, City of the Three Cultures, that sails by the complex conditions of the violent marriage of the mosque and Church of Santa Cruz, enclosing it in a sentimental image of convivencia. Throughout its extensive history, the Tourist Council of Toledo declares, Toledo has been known as a cradle of tolerance, or more recently as the City of Three Cultures, with a coexistence of Jews, Muslims, and Christians. Gregory Hutchinson has written very interestingly about this. Scholarly eye-rolling has more recently amended this statement, but the popularity of this approach remains, to which an outpouring of critical papers analyzing the commodification of contrived cultural utopias can testify. My remarks this term will center on relations between Christians and Muslims, but it must be said that this construct, a cradle of tolerance, was even more disturbing as Toledo's two standing synagogues are drawn into the web of its romanticized version of convivencia. The synagogue of Samuel Halevi Abulafia, Pedro I's chamberlain and treasurer, who enjoyed it only 3 years after he was imprisoned and tortured to death in 1360. Or the synagogue called today Santa Maria la Blanca, for the church it became when St. Vincent Ferrer is thought to have incited a mob to anti-Jewish riots that led to its appropriation at the turn of the 14th century during the years of devastating pogroms. Convivencia, like many liberal pieties, can be dangerous in the wrong hands, as dangerous as Reconquista. We might perhaps best see buildings like Santa Cruz as sets for colonial performances of essentialist ideologies that mask anxieties concerning their multiple, layered, and dynamic identities, not only in this case in the exterior marker of a mosque's Christianization, but also in its absorption into an ideological prism that sought to purify its own creeping transculturation. And then that transculturation wasn't always about Muslims. Because Arabic epigraphy in Santa Cruz hovers ceaselessly between the exotic and the local. In this bilingual funerary cenotaph from Toledo, dated a few decades before Santa Cruz's consecration, the epigraphy is clear and the messages in Latin and Arabic are coherent, complementing one another in their accounts of the death of the Christian Michael, son of Semeno. The Arabic text is slightly more complete and poetic, containing as it does a prayer and the basmala in the name of God, the merciful and compassionate. And the two texts are interwoven, not simply reproducing one another, but progressively complementing one another. In the Toledo into which the Hospitallers had come, Arabic and even the basmala could be dissociated from Islam. At Santa Cruz, the calligraphy is part of a language of forms taken from objects and settings of an urban context shared prioritarily. That was the wrong word. Shared proprietarily. Thank you very much. Shared as if by propriety, not just by Muslims and Mozarabs, but also by Castilians and Franks. And so the Knights of St. John sought to draw their Arabic calligraphy away from that those ambivalent local meanings that people felt entitled to in Toledo, instead to a realm of clarity, something like confessional opposition. The ground of the inscription at Santa Cruz, which is the image on the top, is red and textured in a way that might be interpreted as a textile. And the writing, black with a fine white outline, other characteristics of inscriptions on elite textiles. And here, a later textile of Alfonso's daughter, Berenguela, which has been reversed. Though textiles travel through trade and direct commissioning, they're used here as repeating the appropriation of the mosque from a shared cultural language to a constructed memory of rich spoils of war that served in this tight feel of signification to intensify the chapel's triumphal message. And yet there's also something alive and current about this appropriation. This cursive epigraphy is new and unusual, and likely copied from a model that used Maghribi Tuluth, which is late Almoravid or Mardanishi. Even the context, Al-Yum wal-Iqbal, might have carried a palimpsest of political meanings in the original model. Martinez Enamorado points out that Ibn Mardanish, Alfonso's old vassal, used this refrain at a massive scale in official contexts and in cursive script, and sees it as something approaching a Mardanish, maybe dynastic motto, functioning as Al-Mulk does in Umayyad luxury arts, as a marker of Ibn Mardanish's political identity. And then the way that it enframes the apse at Santa Cruz parallels the use of inscriptions in the Qasr ibn Sa'ad of Ibn Mardanish in Murcia, but possibly also transmitted through local buildings in Toledo or through objects manufactured for royals and local elites. Though Ibn Mardanish had died at least 15 years before, depending on how you date the paintings, this style of epigraphy and its motto were still fashionable at the time they were maladroitly transcribed from a copybook onto the triumphal arch of Santa Cruz. The epigraphy reflects the repeated impact of material culture from tribute or trade, from Ibn Mardanish's period of vassalage to the crown of Castile, perhaps even of luxury goods that arrived in Toledo during his visit 15 years before. And it carried perhaps more of the memory of Ibn Mardanish in particular than the Hospitallers imagined. Ibn Mardanish's gold dinar of an Almoravid type called in Castile Morabettino Lupino, Lupino as in Wolf King, as they called him, to distinguish it from less dependable coinage, became the standard of exchange in medieval Iberia and in the Mediterranean and beyond, something like the florin later on. The Morabettino of Ibn Mardanish, Matteo contends, dominated everything. It was the arbiter of monetary dominion. A year after Ibn Mardanish's death, Alfonso VIII would continue the famous dinar at the same weight and value for trade and for political economy as a means, James Todesca affirms, of stabilizing its economic value and continuing its hegemonic implications. Nixon, too, saw this as a bid for continuity. Its Arabic epigraphy is arranged like that from Ibn Mardanish's mint, as is the language of power, the imam of the church, Christian the Pope. If Ibn Mardanish's coin pronounces him to be Prince of the Believers, and may he be aided by Allah, Alfonso's announces the Prince of the Catholics, Alfonso, son of Sancho, may God aid him and protect him. Balbale will suggest, in fact, that Alfonso was styling himself as the anti-Almohad successor of his former vassal, an idea that greatly complicates the notion of how you defend Christendom and complicates the vision presented in the Hospitallers' Chapel. because incorporating Ibn Mardanish's coinage into Alfonso's material image was part of the construction of his identity as a defender of the Christian faith for the whole messy peninsula, where the rim of Ibn Mardanish's dinar proclaimed, "Follow the path of Allah, and if anyone desires a religion other than Islam, never will it be accepted of him." Alfonso's reposted, "In the name of the Father, and the Son, and the Holy Spirit, the one God, Allah, he that believeth and is baptized shall be saved." More nuanced than conversion, this is translation as transformation. Forms associated with Ibn Mardanish are not permeating Toledo as an instrument of his own political program. In the Church of Santa Cruz, the continuity of this particular kind of Arabic and the motto, Al-Yum Wal-Iqbal, marks the incorporation of the Wolf King's ambivalent identity into the fabric of the city's culture in the years following his alliance with Alfonso VIII, at both random and explicit embrace of his cultural mark. That this fashion should collide with the crusading ideologies of the Hospitallers of St. John is one of the incessant, fabulous ironies that spring from the material histories of medieval Iberia. So it is about Christendom in the end, but it is about a rich, messy Iberian style of Christendom, full of not just Muslim subalterns, but charismatic Muslim allies, Arabized Christians, transformed colonials. The Knights of St. John worked hard to contrive that at Santa Cruz a transcultural palimpsest would appear to be a triumphal appropriation. It was an attempt to polarize Toledo's persistent cultural slippage, as it could be read in the patterns of quotidian patronage. But to reinvent Mardanish calligraphy as uniquely a marker of an exotic other, or as a spoil of war in Toledo, was ultimately futile. The epigraphy and the skin of polylobed arches at Santa Cruz would continue to echo the ways in which the knights themselves were absorbed into the very cultural and political context they sought to control. Religious difference is performative, but also dynamically compensatory at Santa Cruz. It's perhaps in the space between Arabic writing as a token of victory and Arabic writing as a trace of transforming identity that carries the burden of the meaning of the Church of Santa Cruz. To work towards a less agonistic history of art in medieval Iberia, we need perhaps to continuously prod those histories as a protean web of relations rather than as a series of bounded subjects, to destabilize meanings that can be too easily drawn on a map that are meant to appear unsullied by ambivalence. My hope is to explore a few more confusing examples of this with you this term, with this in mind. I should warn you that they never completely untangle. Thank you very much.